Welcome to Biz Rocket Radio with Stone Payton and John Baker. John Baker is a certified financial planner with a Master's of Science in Personal Financial Planning. Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, Inc. owns the certification mark CFP, Certified Financial Planner, TM and CFP, and in the U.S., which it awards to individuals who successfully complete the CFP Board's initial and ongoing certification requirements. John Baker offers financial planning and securities through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor and broker-dealer, member FINRA SIPC, located at 1050 Crown Point Parkway, Suite 1675, Atlanta, Georgia, 30338. This program is for information purposes only and should not be considered a solicitation of or offer to buy or offer to sell securities or investment advisory services. Information in this program regarding market or other financial information is obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable. We do not warrant or guarantee the timeliness or accuracy of this information. When considering any registered security products, seek a prospectus carefully before you invest. Make sure you consult your financial professional regarding any specific situation. And now, get ready for Biz Rocket Radio. Here's Stone Payton and John Baker.
Welcome to Biz Rocket Radio. This is John Baker, and we come to you on a wet Wednesday morning here at Biz Rocket. This is a show that gives us an opportunity to chat with and learn from executives in the Atlanta area, as well as business owners, kind of pick their brain on experiences that they've had, challenges, successes, and learn from some of those experiences. Today we've got two business men with us, Todd Stanton, as well as Austin Thompson. And I'm going to start just by going through some questions here with Todd. So welcome in, Todd. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for having me today.
Did you get in okay? All was well?
I was going the wrong way on 400. It was a mess all the way down, but coming up was fine.
Yeah, that's no 400 in the rain is no fun. So, Todd, maybe you could give us a little bit of background on kind of business experience, kind of where you came from and what you're doing now.
Sure. I was born and raised in the Atlanta area. I graduated from Marist High School. Went to Washington and Lee for undergrad and moved back and worked in actually up this way for the 4 years after undergrad, working for a small computer services firm. And as I was watching a business owner struggle with the employee issues that he had and the regulatory issues that he faced, made the decision to go back to law school. I graduated from University of Georgia in 2002 and focused while I was there on employment law, not as much labor law, traditional union organization, those types of things, but on the employer-employee relationship. Because of my political bent, it made sense that I focused on management defense. Was given an opportunity to work for a large boutique firm here in Atlanta, Fisher & Phillips. Mm-hmm. Stayed at Fisher & Phillips until 2006 when I moved to Powell Goldstein. Powell Goldstein merged with Bryan Cave in 2008, and I've recently taken that big law experience and tried to form a more nimbler shop to meet the needs of small and medium-sized businesses as opposed to those institutional clients that may have the better resources to be able to afford the expertise that Fisher & Phillips or Bryan Cave can offer.
All right, so I get to get some free legal advice today, right?
No charge. And that is overvalued.
So thinking about business owners and what they go through on a daily basis, what are some of the things that small to medium-sized business owners are not thinking about that they really should be thinking about?
I think that the most common issues that I see coming up are just a lack of understanding of employment law. In many cases, employment law, you have to set common sense aside. You have a person who's missed 15, 20 days of work in the past month. I want to get rid of them. It makes complete sense to a business owner. When that issue comes to me, though, we might have to say, no, that not so much. I mean, if it's a serious health condition, if we've got a disability involved, and if they're subject to those federal laws, we might have to take a step back and do it a different way. I think that two of the most common problems that I see are, and it's on my, just recently wrote articles about both of these issues, I don't have to pay people overtime because I pay them a salary. Unfortunately, the Fair Labor Standards Act doesn't allow business owners to make the determination about whether somebody is entitled to overtime or not. I also see employers say, I don't mess with employees. I just have independent contractors. Well, again, that sort of contractual designation is all well and good as long as things are happy. But as soon as the Department of Labor or plaintiff's attorney gets involved, there are going to be other issues involved.
Right. And when you're looking at, you talked about federal law standards. Now, my understanding was in Georgia in particular, if you don't like the way the person dresses, you can get rid of them. You don't have to have cause. Is that true? Am I way off base?
No, you're not way off base at all. Georgia is a very employer-friendly state. And the doctrine to which you're referring is the at-will doctrine. And our state laws are very employer-friendly and are very protective of the at-will doctrine, which you're correct, is that you can fire somebody for a good reason, bad reason, or no reason at all, as long as it's not any legal reason. Mm. And that's really where federal law steps in. Mm-hmm. Title VII is the one that most people are familiar with, which protects race, color, national origin, religion, gender, those sorts of things. I can't take an adverse employment action against you because of a protected characteristic. Age would be another one. Disability would be another one under other federal laws.
Right.
So if I were to fire you because I don't like the blazer that you're wearing, this is a fine blazer for my standards.
Thank you very much.
That would be a...
It's a little wrinkly, but, you know.
That would be a poor reason to fire someone, but not an illegal reason.
Right.
Now, if I were to fire you because you're over 40 and I have more than 20 employees, that becomes an illegal reason. If I were to fire you because you're a white guy, that becomes an illegal reason. Disparate treatment is one of the many areas where employers can get into trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see employers taking action because of those protected characteristics intentionally. It's where they kind of stumble into something. It's where they, for instance, would take action against somebody for being late to work because of child care issues. If you're treating a woman differently under those circumstances than you are a man,
mm-hmm.
that becomes a problem under Title VII.
Mm-hmm.
But you're correct. That Georgia employers have a lot of leeway to take the actions against employees who aren't making the grade.
So the people that you're working with, the organizations with you're working with, describe what they might look like. Who's your typical clientele or your sweet spot?
Well, that's a good question. In larger firms, in larger law firms, the rates structure is such that institutional clients are probably the ones who we're focused on. When I ventured out into Stanton Law, I'm looking for anywhere from 5 employees to 200 employees, 250 employees. Above that, we start getting into employment issues that I'm going to have to enlist other resources with. When I size a company, I do it in terms of employees, not in terms of revenue necessarily, and I don't really focus on an industry segment. Certain attorneys do it that way. In my experience, the employment issues with which I'm most comfortable dealing are cross-industry. It's not tied to any particular job duties or anything along those lines. Perhaps an example is the best one that I can get. Recently, we got a call from a countertop installer. And as you can imagine, a countertop installer over the past 2 years has been taking a complete bath.
Yeah.
Their business is not running as well as it was during the housing boom. And they have had to lay off a number of folks. One of the people that they laid off went and got an attorney and wrote a demand letter to the client that was asking for $75,000 in back wages. The woman who wrote the demand letter claimed that she was a non-exempt employee, that she was entitled to overtime for the hours that she worked in excess of 40 in a work week. $75,000 to this guy might as well have been $10 billion. He could not cut that kind of check. Came to us and said, well, how can you help? And I said, well, with my rate structure where it is at the big firm, it's going to cost you $50,000 to $75,000 to $100,000 to defend this lawsuit. Well, again, he's right between a rock and a hard place. He can't go forward and can't go back.
Yep.
With Stanton Law, I'm able to then work with him to figure out how we can negotiate this problem with the other attorney, with the other side. And with the demand letter, since that demand letter's cut, in most cases, the employer is going to be writing checks. And whether it's to a law firm, whether it's to a plaintiff's counsel, whether it's to a plaintiff, that's a one-way street. And that money is not recoverable.
Right.
I will be able to offer a better fee structure and make it a more affordable proposition for the small and medium-sized businesses who right now aren't being represented. And this particular guy, to close the loop, ended up mediating the claim by himself and going in with a payment plan to this attorney and her client. Not because he necessarily thought that she had been paid improperly, but simply because he had to get rid of it to save his business.
Right.
And that's one of the things that catch 22 that business owners face of do I settle this out and worry about a line of plaintiffs? Do I pay my attorney a bazillion dollars to try and defend this on principle alone? I pride myself on being able to go in and objectify the decision and say, I understand that this is personal to you. But your personal principles are going to bankrupt your company if you take this as far as it goes.
So when you, I would imagine being proactive in this is a lot better than being reactive. What are the kinds of things that an employer can do to be proactive in protecting against these types of lawsuits before they get going?
I would say the first thing is to have a solid employment policy manual, a solid employee handbook. That is the bare minimum an employer should have, and that doesn't matter whether you have two employees or 300. Having a lawful employment handbook is the first thing that would be done. I would advise against going out and pulling various policies off the internet. You don't know where those have done. That's a proactive step that employers can take for a relatively inexpensive amount of money, relatively low amount of money that is going to pay dividends down the line. It gives people a foundation from which to start all their employee issues. What I have found, though, is that talking with employers, small and medium-sized business owners, about getting an employee handbook, about these proactive steps, I turn into an insurance salesman. Nobody's going to like paying me money for that proactive stuff. They'll say, well, I haven't had any problems. This is a family-run business. Everybody gets along, which is true. And a lot of those people never have those employment problems. It's when a problem comes up, it's very difficult to retroactively apply those employment policies when for $1,500, $2,000, $3,000 bucks, we could have gotten a foundation in place to at least give you a reference point on how to deal with those issues as they come up.
Mm-hmm.
The employers who have gone through an EEOC charge, who have gone through a lawsuit, they're not a difficult sell when it comes to employment policies. They understand that those bills pile up very quickly and how disruptive it can be. I would like to get to the point where we don't have that problem anymore. I would like to have small and medium-sized business owners who say, come help me get a handbook in place and we'll get out ahead of these problems. That's a tough sell, but that would be my first recommendation, is getting an employee handbook in place.
And what's the update with non-compete contracts? Last year, I heard all sorts of changes going on there. There was a new rule that came in that allowed people, the judge, to blue pen or something the information that's in there, and then it got messed up with a vote, and then it had to go back to re-vote. And is that done now? Is that squared away?
The new law is in place. And what you're speaking of is restrictive covenants. Restrictive covenants is the broader term for the non-competition, the non-solicitation agreements, the confidentiality agreements that a lot of employers do put in place, particularly with salespeople, particularly with customer-facing positions, who don't want the investment they've made in their employees to be used against them later down the road at the employee's subsequent employer. Up until the new law went into place, Georgia law was unfriendly towards these type of restrictive covenants. There was a lot of uncertainty in what covenants were going to be enforced, what you could prohibit an employee from doing in his subsequent employment. That's not necessarily a good thing or a bad thing. If you are trying to recruit an advisor who's coming from another advisory firm, you would prefer the law to take a very lax approach to enforcement of that new employee's former restrictive covenant.
Right.
On the other hand, the minute he walks out the door, suddenly you want it to be very, very strictly enforced.
Right.
And you'd like to prohibit him from doing any number of things. So it's not objectively good or bad, but what the problem with Georgia law was it was very uncertain. It was with all due respect to the state judiciary, it really depended on what judge you got. They're, like any litigation, very cost intensive. There's a flurry of activity at the beginning. Lawyers make a bunch of money, and then it all kind of shakes out at the end. And so a lot of people either weren't enforcing them or trying enforcing them and unhappy with the ruling, then again, the appellate court. The law was a mess. And the legislature, to its credit, looked at that and said, let's try and put some boundaries on this. They have made my job easier. To draft enforceable restrictive covenants is an easier proposition now than it was before. That's not to say that I can offer certainty to you as a business owner that you're going to be able to prohibit employees from going to a competitor X or soliciting customer Y, but I stand a better chance of hitting that nail on the head with the proactive documents. The concept that you were talking about is blue penciling. Mm-hmm. Under the state of the law before the new act went into effect, when a covenant was overbroad, so it fell on its face and was unenforceable as a matter of law. So if I sought to prohibit you from a former employee from competing with me in the entire state of Georgia, and I couldn't demonstrate that I had a protectable interest in prohibiting you from competing in the state of Georgia, that entire covenant went away, and I couldn't prohibit you from competing anywhere. Under the state of the law, as it's being fleshed out now, the statute specifically allows for a judge to blue pencil, to rewrite that covenant to make it reasonable and prohibit you from interfering with my as an employer's protectable interest. That creates a kind of a moral hazard for employers, mm-hmm. and that why wouldn't I go out and make my covenants as broad as possible to prohibit you from as much activity as I think I can get away with, knowing that the judge is just going to simply rewrite that.
Right.
The only real incentive that I've found to keep employers from doing that is the cost of litigation and having the judge perhaps rewrite something that you don't like.
Exactly. They might say, well, this is way too broad, so I'm going to go the other direction.
And pull it all the way back. I, as a general rule, don't smile upon non-competition agreements. Those are tough to do. And if I boil down, and when I really get to the meat of what the employer wants to protect, it's client relationships. Mm-hmm. And non-solicitation covenants are much easier to draft. They're much easier to enforce. And again, the new law has provided us with some good structure on what we can prohibit. And it is allowable for up to 2 years in a general sense. And of course, I would advise anybody to have these particularly drafted for any specific position. Mm-hmm. But I, as a general rule, for up to 2 years can keep you from calling on customers with whom you had material contact while you were working for me. And you think about it, that's really what the rub of it is. You want to keep them from taking their golden Rolodex that you funded for meals and entertainment and training that person, all of those other things, and taking their clients to their new shop.
We're going to run a little bit of time. I want to talk a little bit more about your business and how do you differentiate yourself from all the other organizations out there and the law firms, big, small, medium, that are doing what you do?
I think any lawyer is going to tell you that they give you practical business advice, right? And it's very difficult to differentiate on lawyerly skill or that practical claim there. I think what's important when selecting an attorney, whether it's an employment attorney or whether it's a transactional attorney or whether it's a commercial litigator, is finding somebody whose style matches yours. My style is not going to be one that we go pound down doors and litigate for the sake of litigating. If you're interested in burying your plaintiff, if somebody sues you for employment discrimination and you're interested in pounding them with discovery and drawing this thing out for several years, I'm probably not your litigator in that standpoint. My goal is I represent your business, not you. And it's going to be my job to come in and say, here's how you keep this business bottom line intact. Now, one of the considerations that we'll have to look at is there a line of plaintiffs? So if we settle this out, if we have pay to make this problem go away, is there going to be a line at the door?
Mm-hmm.
I don't see that as much as people fear it. that is a consideration, but that's one of the factors that we'll put into the calculus of, do we defend this? Do we litigate this until it's resolution? Or do we try and protect your bottom line and write a smaller check up front than we do at the beginning? And I don't mean to be callous about this. An employer facing an employment law situation is going to be writing checks. It's always the client's decision about to whom they write them. My job is to make sure, and where I think I differentiate this is, I would much rather have you satisfied or less unsatisfied with a particular outcome early than it would be where you've written $125,000 worth of checks and are still unsatisfied with the outcome.
Right.
Very few of my clients come out of this saying, super awesome.
Yeah.
That was a great experience all
awesome.
The way around.
So glad
yeah,
I got
nobody,
sued.
Nobody, I don't get much kudos when it comes that way.
Tell me what led you to, we talked a little bit about why you left kind of the big law firm environment. Tell me a little bit about what that transition has been like. What's the biggest challenge you faced that maybe you could impart on other people that might be looking at doing that, maybe in even other businesses?
The biggest challenge, I guess the switch kind of flicked for me back last spring as I looked at what my career path was and what my legal practice was going to look like. And I decided that I could probably give this a go. And I had a gentleman named Mathesh Patel, who's just started another law firm in the area, MJ Patel Law Group. And I watched him move from big law into a smaller law firm environment until he eventually went out on his own. And so I had the benefit of watching him kind of experiment with the different firm structures until he found one. Now, he's certainly been an inspiration as far as knowing that it can be done. And then as I took what he had said and watched other people and interviewed other people about how they had done it, it's a one-way street. You see people leaving the bigger law firms and going out into smaller firms. You don't see many people going back to that big law environment, and I think that's pretty telling. Hmm. And as I asked people, what would you do differently as you went out on your own, the one thing that I heard over and over again was, I would have done it earlier.
Yeah.
People don't understand why it took them so long to do it. I did not hear it was a horrible decision. I didn't hear, I can't wait to go back. I didn't hear, what I did hear was, I wish I had saved more money. But to me, that's a different statement than, I did this too soon.
Right.
And look, I'm a newbie at this, and so my experience is going to be unfolding in front of me.
Yep.
It is amazing how busy I can be with nothing to do. Is I think one of the first things that I've come to the conclusion. There is always something that I feel like I could be doing to improve my business or to better serve my clients. Whether it's writing another article, whether it's updating my websites, whether it's just making marketing calls or sales calls or say hello calls. It's very difficult to turn off the office light and leave the office when it's all you do.
Right. We're going to come back to you here in a second because we're going to use you as a guinea pig in the next section, which I've already gotten your permission on. I'm going to have Austin do a little bit of a branding consultation. But before I leave, you kind of at this point, we always like to ask our guests about a question that they can put on other individuals, something that they can leave as kind of a final thought. What would your final thought be to the listeners as maybe a pearl of wisdom?
I think that business owners underestimate how disruptive employment issues can be. And at this point, I do sound like an insurance salesman. The earlier I can get involved and the earlier I can take a look at issues and not necessarily even correct things, but because you have limited resources, but to put together a plan of the things that you need to be looking at and what I see as the potential roadblocks that you're going to be running into, that either you're not paying your folks properly or there's an argument that you're not. That not having a harassment policy in place when you have 10 employees isn't a big deal. We can work around that.
Mm-hmm.
But the minute that you hire that 15th employee and become subject to those federal laws, if like I said, it's difficult to put those in retroactively. take a look at your employment practices, and if it's not something that you've looked at, if you've grown organically from 2 to 20 to 25 folks, you're a target now. And everybody likes their employees when they're productive and happy. It's when somebody gets disgruntled that becomes the problem. Examine those and find a lawyer, either your general practitioner to whom to refer. Start taking a look at that is what I would say. Put it on your radar screen. It's not something that you're going to make money. It's not a revenue generator, but it sure can be a revenue drainer.
So if someone wants to reach out to you, Todd, and get in contact, how's the best way to reach out?
One of the things that I assume Austin's going to talk about with this branding is a web presence. And as I've launched Stanton Law, I worked with another small business, Bonnie Russick with BBR Marketing, who really helped out and put together a very good web presence, in my opinion. And that website is www.stantonlawllc.com. There's a sister website to that, the intownemployer.org blog. That'll give information on me. Certainly have my contact information there. I think that more broadly, though, making sure that my style of practice is going to fit with what your style of business is. Like I said, I'm not going to be every person's attorney.
Mm-hmm.
But the website is one that I would direct people to.
Okay, perfect. Thank you very much for your time. We're going to come back to you just in a second.
Sure.
Austin Thompson is our next guest. And Austin's got a new book out that he's hitting the streets on. And he's gone from electrical engineer to branding expert. And I can't wait to hear about how that all happened. So welcome in, Austin.
Yeah, the brand guru, I guess.
That's right. So tell us a little bit about your background and kind of how you got to where you are now.
Well, first of all, I'm originally from the Republic of Guyana, South America. Immigrated to the United States in Brooklyn, New York, where I lived for about 15 years. And then relocated to Atlanta, Georgia in 1992. So I've been here in 19 years. And currently living in the Duluth, Lawrenceville area of Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
My background is sort of diverse. I come from a project engineering background, engineering and technology, working with compliance testing labs in a EMC compliance regulatory capacity, as well as project management, and also branching out of my own. In addition to that, doing some business consulting with entrepreneurs and small business owners who are looking for someone to help them on the path of business planning, how to write a business plan, put a business plan together. What is marketing? I don't know how to market. You know,
right.
What are the steps that I would need in order to effectively put a marketing plan together or a marketing campaign,
mm-hmm.
To understand the financial analysis and doing the pro forma projections for a business plan. And these were some of the things that early on I worked with entrepreneurs and small business owners who pretty much sought me out to assist them with.
And now you've kind of developed that into a business where, from a consulting perspective, it's what you're doing.
Right. From a consulting perspective, I'm still working as a project engineer here in Atlanta, but also building and growing that consulting business,
mm-hmm.
as well as working through Shorter University as an adjunct professor where I teach project management.
Mm-hmm.
So, like I said, I come from a very diverse background. I sort of have my hands in so many different things. It sort of makes it interesting.
So There is a lot of buzz and activity around this whole concept of branding. It has been for several years, really.
Yes.
But now people are talking personal branding, and you know, with all the social media and LinkedIn and Facebook and all these other websites, that anything you say and do electronically is there forever, and you know, you've got to protect and have that brand that you own. Tell us a little bit more about your view on branding and how people can successfully brand their business or their overall themselves.
Right. In the process of working with entrepreneurs, the one thing I realized was that individuals and a lot of the entrepreneurs I work with are, you know, sole proprietors who are forming LLCs and that kind of thing. And the one thing I realized was that they were not making that correlation between branding themselves as an individual with branding the service and products that they are selling through their company.
Hmm.
So my goal or my strategy was to help them make that comparison and understand that as you are trying to establish and grow and perfect an image for your service and for your products, you also, as the face of your company, have to understand that there are certain things that you need to do in order to strengthen yourself. Because when people see your business, they see your logo, they see your name, they also see you, because you're the everyday contact that they're engaging with the business.
Mm-hmm.
Personal branding, as I like to say, if you look at major companies like Coca-Cola, Delta, you know, these are major strong brands, you know, Virgin Airlines. And, you know, as entrepreneurs, you pretty much have to adhere to the same code of branding and creating an image as major corporations do for their products and their brands. When selling a product or service, understanding how you, the person, come across, the image you leave or the impression that you leave on the minds of individuals with whom you come into contact. Small business owners, again, have more of a challenge because they are engaging the customers as opposed to big major companies. They can pay for, you know, branding research and all of this kind of thing. And you have a customer service department, which is sort of like a faceless department. You're interacting with customers over the phone, and you know, you have other things that are pretty much there in front of the clients. But as a small business owner, understanding that your brand strength, the strength of your image, also comes across as well as the strength of your product and service.
So who needs to be thinking about branding?
Everybody. In my book, I originally started writing the book for entrepreneurs because, of course, of my consulting practice. But I decided to expand that and to target corporate professionals who are also should be cognizant of branding and growing a personal image.
Give me an example when you say corporate professionals.
Anyone who's looking to, you know, move up in the company, executives, senior level executives, of course, middle level managers who are looking to move up into higher positions, who are basically are being looked at as prospects for that next CEO's position or that next senior management's position. Understanding that, you know, in growing their brand and how they come across to the company, representing the company, being the kind of person that can relate to their employees, to the subordinates, building that reputation with being a people person, being the kind of person that not can only meet the bottom line projections, but also can come across and grow that base with the people with whom they work.
So it's entrepreneurs and business owners, but also
college students, and then
within corporate America, it's employees. I mean, it's those people that are trying to create a reputation for themselves,
exactly,
where they're kind of writing their own experience resume almost,
exactly,
live, right?
Exactly. You know, with the college students also, when I expanded, I decided to write on the branding piece for college students because as young people, you don't necessarily, when you're going into college at 18 and 19, you're not thinking about building an image. You're thinking about going on to college. You're thinking about having fun, joining that fraternity, you know, hanging out with friends. And you're not thinking that, and especially now in the digital age when we talk about MySpace and Facebook, and you're placing all these pictures of drinking and binging and all these things, you're not realizing that these things hurt you.
Yeah.
You know, you're not realizing that not building that relationship with your dean and your professors and the administrators who actually have the contacts that can really help you, or taking the responsibility to pursue that co-op or that internship that will help you, you know, make that career for yourself once you leave college. You know, so that's some of the things that I introduce in the book on certain steps that college students should take. You know, just recognizing that building a brand is very important even to a freshman coming into college, because what you want is that by the time you reach your senior year, you're headed in that direction you wanted to go when you first came into college.
So let's target that corporate executive just for a second. What are some of the top things that you talk to those, or maybe it's in the book, obviously,
right,
but that you're targeting those corporate execs or future execs to do to help build a brand?
Honesty and integrity is one other thing, especially with executives, and especially with individuals who are pursuing political careers, who have that connection on the political side. But honesty and integrity is important because when we're dealing with conflict of interest, we're dealing with code of ethics. When we look at what has happened with Enron, companies like Enron, Anderson Consulting, some of the decisions that were made by those executives that took down those companies, you know, the integrity and the honesty is very important as an executive, as you're building your brand. Again, because you're working alongside with the company and looking to build the brand and the honesty of the company as well.
What about through the social media side of things? Are there, and maybe this maybe works into the entrepreneurs and small business owners, what are the kind of things that they need to be doing to help establish a brand and build the credibility of that brand?
Well, like Todd explained, just going out from the big firm and going on his own and establishing his law firm. On that side, for the small business, the web presence is very important. For instance, like on my website, and doing the things that's basically relative to my background, I'm building a website that focuses on my teaching experience, my experience as a public speaker, my experience as an author, as a writer, and basically all of the things that I put on my website basically paints a picture, paints a story of who I am, you know, and the things that I do. The book signings that I go to, I make sure that I have pictures of the book signings and the people with whom that I'm engaging in conversation, interviews and video that I place on the website, different articles that I will be loading on the website that I'll be writing. So it helps to, you know, to help build my brand as well, you know, and to give credibility to who I am as a person.
And how, let's take Todd as an example. Mm-hmm. I'm going to kind of bring Todd back into the discussion here. Let's say that you were working with Todd and helping him brand his practice,
right,
his business, which is kind of up and running and off and going. He's got a website.
Right.
What are some of the questions that you'd go through with him? What would the process be to help him figure out a branding strategy?
Well, what I would do is just sit down and find out exactly what his mission is for his law firm, where he wants his looking at his vision, where he's looking long term as far as growing his business and growing his law firm. And then sitting down and trying to paint a picture and to sort of create a direction in which he can go in terms of growing his brand as an attorney. And some of the things, taking a look at some of the pitfalls that other attorneys have fallen into. I mean, you look, if we look at in the book, I made reference to John Edwards, who is we know him as a former vice presidential candidate, former presidential candidate, very strong in the trial law area. Pretty much fell victim to, you know, sex scandal with a videographer.
Because that's the first thing I thought of when you mentioned the name. All the good stuff went right out the door.
Exactly. So, you know, look, I mean, we have to be real about this. You know, we're all human beings and we're all prone to mistakes. And you can have something, you know, that you can do that's mild, that can, you know, can cause a little damage to your brand from which you can recover quickly. Or you can go through something disastrous that take a lot more time for disaster control, you know, or damage control, you know. But what I would do with Todd, I would sit down and I would say, hey, well, where are you going? What do you want to do? How far are you looking ahead in terms of long-term, intermediate, short-term plan for growing your law firm? And just basically trying to find out what it is that I can carve out for him in order to help him grow his brand digitally through his website, meeting with his clients, putting together a risk mitigation plan with him. And in the book, I discussed about escape routes, so basically planning ahead on certain things and playing certain situations out in your mind as to what can go wrong. It's like the what ifs. You know, what can go wrong? What if I made this decision? What if I made that decision? What if I had this client or prospective client come through the door? would I take that client? Why would I take that client? What was the reason for me? What would be the reason for me taking such a, such a client? You know, because sometimes, you know, with whom you build that relation can also hurt your brand, you know, especially in his business, you know. So all these things I would go through, you know, in terms of helping him grow his brand.
So, Todd, just as a question, have you thought, I mean, down the road, kind of what your vision is of what you want to have the firm look like?
Yes. I think that that's one of the things that any good marketing person is going to, a branding person is going to help you focus on that, and certainly have benefited from that. I would agree with you that having the vision is important. It is finding the time to taking it out of a day-to-day, just making it till I can go to bed tonight because I'm tired.
Yeah.
Idea. Focusing on that, taking time each day to focus on what did I do today to reach that vision?
Right.
What did I do today? I would like to grow my practice. I don't want to be a solo practitioner forever.
Okay. Right. So you want to have other attorneys and people there and kind of build a firm?
Yes. Yeah. And I think that having that as my goal, what did I do today to put me in a better position tomorrow to grow that firm? I can't answer it every day that I did anything.
Right.
There are certain days that you're too busy.
Right.
But keeping that on the radar screen, keeping it in a focus is a big deal. And I would imagine that you have the same trouble that I do. Going in and proactively selling that into somewhere is a difficult, be a difficult proposition to sell.
Right. Because some people would say, well, why would I need to worry about branding? I mean, I have a pretty good image. I pretty much know how to promote myself. But it's not about knowing how to promote yourself. It's knowing how to have that sustainable growth in growing your brand and making sure that you do that or take the necessary steps to make sure that that brand stays robust.
Mm-hmm.
Because in a small business environment, it's much more important because the market has choices. They can either be loyal to you or they can be loyal to someone else. But as an entrepreneur, it's all about knowing how to make sure that you have loyalty from your customers and you're loyal to your customers, building that commitment, doing the customer service. You know, and from Todd's perspective, being a small business owner, you're the owner, you're the customer service person, you're the receptionist, you're the secretary, you're the marketing person. So you have all these hats that you wear, but it's understanding that, okay, today I have this customer, I have this client. Will 5 years down the road, will I still have this client? Will this client still be loyal to me?
Mm-hmm.
Or would that customer still be loyal to me? But, you know, it's understanding how you keep that client, how you keep that customer loyal to you. And it's building that relationship. It's doing the things that to keep in touch with your customer, the newsletters that you send out, calling a customer or a client just to say, hey, how you doing? I haven't heard from you in a while. You know, it shows the customer that you care. It shows that you're not just trying to engage the person one time just to get money and, you know, grow revenue, meet a bottom line, and that's it, you know. But it's building that loyalty because customers out there, they're looking to build a relationship with a business owner.
Tell me more about the book. You've published the book. I take it it's out and available?
Yes, it's out and available. Amazon.com. BarnesandNobles.com, and I'm currently working on getting some shelf space at some of the independent bookstores.
And what's the if you outline the book, if somebody went there and they bought the book, what would they walk away from after going through and reading it?
Well, the title of the book is A Brand New You, Taking Ownership of Your Personal Brand. And the title speaks to the fact that it's the importance of taking ownership of growing your brand, doing the important things to really to build that robust image that you know, leaves a positive impression on the minds of people with whom come into contact with you. In the book, I have a framework for a professional development plan where individuals can go through and they can put together a personal development plan based on a vision that they have for themselves, where they see themselves. And it doesn't have to be entrepreneurs. It could be for professionals who are looking to grow themselves and develop themselves, college students as well, where they see themselves in 4 years,
mm-hmm.
you know, where they see themselves in 10 years, you know, putting together a personal mission statement, creating measurable and achievable goals and objectives, looking at developing a timeline and building a personal SWOT analysis on yourselves, looking at your strengths. And some people would say that, hey, I don't have any weaknesses, but you do have weaknesses, you know, and looking at some of those weaknesses that you can turn into opportunities and then also looking at some of the threats that would harm your brand and that would be a risk to your brand. But the personal development plan includes all of that and incorporates that into a framework that one can use, and it's at the back of the book. And that's one of the key selling points that I use for the book.
And the title of the book was, again?
A Brand New You, Taking Ownership of Your Personal Brand.
Okay. So in terms of your business and kind of the book writing piece, mm-hmm. what's that taught you going through that whole process of becoming an author and getting out on the marketing side of that? How's that work with you?
Well, it works good. It works hand in hand because, you know, this is something that I offer as a consultant, you know, helping entrepreneurs and small business owners create that personal brand. And the book actually was birthed out of material I was putting together for a workshop. And I was putting together some material, doing some research on personal branding. And I hit a point where I said, wow, you know, I'd like to write a book on this. I'm doing all this research, putting together material. And, you know, I had sufficient enough material to really start something. And I said, well, you know, I'm going to put together this document, this outline, and then see where I go from that. And then it led from creating the outline for working professionals to entrepreneurs to college students to dealing with digital branding, dealing with the piece on personality, having a strong personality, to doing the professional development plan, and then also to doing a survey with several professionals, with about 100 professionals that I had to do a survey on different things that, you know, that helps to really create a strong image for yourself as a professional. So that's where it came out from.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. So we'll also leave you with the last question here on your mm-hmm. pearl of wisdom. What would you leave for our listeners today?
Well, with the listeners, I would say, you know, it's never too late to begin building a brand for yourself. And again, whether you're a corporate professional, whether you're an entrepreneur, college student, retiree, or you're out of work, unemployed, and you're looking to get back into corporate America, get back out to work. And, you know, it's very important because we're living in a competitive society. We live in a global competitive society now. And having that brand and having that image that people can identify with positively is a very important thing because it's all about standing out among the crowd. It's all about creating a competitive advantage, whether you're, again, an entrepreneur or a corporate professional. And having people recognize you and having individuals recognize you for who you are, that being that outstanding person, it's very important.
Okay. Well, appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Austin and also Todd, thank you guys for both coming in and sharing some of your experiences with us. We will see everybody again next week at the same time. Until that time, be safe.
John Baker is a certified financial planner with a Master's of Science in Personal Financial Planning. Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, Inc. owns the certification mark CFP, Certified Financial Planner, TM and CFP, and in the U.S., which it awards to individuals who successfully complete the CFP Board's initial and ongoing certification requirements. John Baker offers financial planning and securities through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor and broker-dealer, member FINRA. SIPC, located at 1050 Crown Point Parkway, Suite 1675, Atlanta, Georgia 30338. This program is for information purposes only and should not be considered a solicitation of or offer to buy or offer to sell securities or investment advisory services. Information in this program regarding market or other financial information is obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable. We do not warrant or guarantee the timeliness or accuracy of this information. When considering any registered security products, seek a prospectus carefully before you invest. Make sure you consult your financial professional regarding any specific situation. We'll be right back.